The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week. John Federson with you today reading The Independent, this issue dated August the 14th of 2026. First up, remediation of former landfill sites still in limbo despite years-long closures of parks. This story from Durham. The notation of a city incinerator on a 1937 map of Durham that hung in Daniel Richter's lab was originally just a hint. Richter, a soils and forest ecology professor at Duke University, noticed that the waste-burning site had been at an intersection near what is now a city park, sparking concerns of potential contamination. So in 2021, Richter started working with Eniko Bihari, a master's student looking for field research opportunities to test the soil at three Durham parks in historically black neighborhoods near other former incinerator sites. The researchers found high levels of lead, a neurotoxin that can cause chronic illness and is particularly harmful to children's physical and mental development. Bihari, who completed her master's at Duke and is now a PhD student at Columbia in New York, quote, "At one of the parks we sampled, there was a riverbed and a ravine with a creek in it. We scraped the soil off the side of the ravine, and you could see layers of debris." Richter and Bihari's findings led to further testing by city contractors, which ultimately forced sections of five Durham City parks to close in 2023. Since then, parks and playgrounds in Zebulon, Greensboro, and Charlotte have closed because of similar contamination, with no reopening date in sight. These parks are part of the NC Department of Environmental Quality's pre-regulatory landfill program that was created in 2007 to find, record, and monitor inactive hazardous substance or waste disposal sites that, prior to 1983, were not regulated. In July, the Office of the State Auditor released a report assessing the performance of that program. They found that 534 of 688 these pre-regulatory landfill sites have not been investigated or actively monitored. Over 80% of the 688 sites are near residences, schools, daycare facilities, and other community spaces. The auditor's report says, without monitoring across these 688 sites, the state lacks reliable information to determine whether hazardous substances are present, whether they pose a risk to public health, or whether additional investigation or remediation is needed. The report also says that limited funds and inaccessible private properties have stalled remediation and monitoring. It estimates that it would take 99 years to address all the sites in the program with current resources. The DEQ report estimates that the state can only afford to remediate 5 to 6 sites per year. These financial limitations mean that city parks across North Carolina have been closed for years awaiting cleanup. Ashley Daniels, programming and organizing director at Toxic Free NC in Durham, said Durham residents have not had full access to their parks for 3 summers. They're also worried about the health implications of the contamination. In 25, Toxic Free NC started working with community partners to host soil screening, health outreach, and partnership at Soil Shop. Soil Shop events in each of the 5 affected parks, East End, East Durham, Lyon, L-Y-O-N, Northgate, and Walltown parks. Daniels said people have really wanted to know what their engagement with the parks could imply for their health, what it could imply for their private property if they are adjacent to the parks or really close to them, what it means for the water around the parks. As part of the events, Durham residents and soil shop team members took soil samples from properties near the park to test for contaminants. From participating neighbors' homes, the soil shop team found that 12% of lead samples in these areas were above the threshold of 200 parts per million set by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA. Daniel said while team members were out canvassing for the soil shop events in East Durham, they met one new resident who did not know about the contamination. He lived close to the park, but the soil shop canvass was the first time he had heard of potential risks, said Daniels. Senator Sophia Chitlick, Democrat of Durham, who represents all five of these affected parks, said her constituents are asking for, quote, the most basic information, saying people want interim resources. They want some level of clarity about what will happen and when it will happen. Chitlick said that while Durham Parks and Rec is doing its best, the state does not have a plan to provide extra support at scale. The city installed orange net fencing around portions of the park to limit access. Richter, a 40-year resident of Durham, said it's frustrating that children often step over this fencing and still play in some areas with contamination. Wade Walcott, who directs Durham Parks and Rec, told NC Health News they plan to improve the fencing to ensure that people aren't getting into unsafe areas. He also said they'll update signs with information about what is happening and why, in addition to scheduling more community update meetings. Greensboro residents are waiting for similar information about Bingham Park. Richter, whose research focuses on city soil issues throughout the United States and internationally, said contaminants at Greensboro's Bingham Park were discovered more than 10 years ago and have been alienating the community since. The park was fenced off but officially closed in spring of 2024. Reginald Sloan III grew up playing and shooting basketball in Bingham Park. He said the park was being worked on for a while till recently when neighborhood murmurs of a reopening quieted. Sloan said, I remember on Facebook, we was all waiting for the park to get done so we could start throwing cookouts and stuff out there, and as of right now, I haven't heard anything else about it. From April 1st to June 30th, Southern Environmental Law Center solicited public comment from community members to send to DEQ and the City of Greensboro about the proposed Bingham Park Remedial Action Plan. Over 100 residents wrote variations of clean up the trash and have a safe, clean park for kids. Sloan said that's a lot of land. It would be beautiful for the community. Contamination at Durham and Greensboro is also an issue of environmental justice, residents and advocates say. Historically, predominantly black and brown neighborhoods have been dumping sites for toxic waste. As early as 1922, Greensboro residents were speaking out against environmental injustice at what would become Bingham Park. Over 100 years ago, black citizens gathered to protest the city's plan to use 10 acres of land to dump and burn toxic waste, according to the local Bingham Park Justice Project. The same 1937 map of Durham in Richter's office shows multiple city incinerators near racially segregated streets that were home to black residents. Chitlick described the situation in Durham's park as a, quote, visible wound of neglect. We know this will be a historical pattern, particularly in our black communities across the state. We know this is a classic environmental justice trope we will see play out. When landfills and incinerator sites like those in Durham were abandoned decades ago, neighborhoods celebrated when they were turned into parks, said Richter. Quote, everyone seems to know about lead, but this is nothing less than a tragic situation of the local communities losing faith in their parks. Greensboro residents voiced this lost faith when they submitted comments about remediating Bingham. Fix it like you would if it was in Irving Park, was a resident wrote, referring to the park in a predominantly white neighborhood that was previously off-limits for working-class communities of color. No one should be living in areas that can cause cancer and other diseases that prevail in neighborhoods of black and brown people, wrote another. Though parts of parks across the state have been closed off for years, with many remaining in investigative phases, Richter said there is some good news, a growing interest in risk reduction remediation methods. One of those is a, quote, cap and cover method, which would place a physical barrier over contaminated soil. Richter saying it does not preclude ongoing investigations that are being done, but reduces the exposure risk immediately with hundreds of truckloads of clean soil, for example. Kendall Wimberly, policy manager at Toxic Free NC, said this method may make sense for some old landfill sites, but other techniques may be needed at a park where communities want to maintain green space. Wimberly said, "We've been in a waiting game for a while, but the city of Durham recognizes the need for being thoughtful about what these options should look like. And maybe it looks a little bit different from each park, for each park, based on what that is and what input from the community is." The state auditor's report recommends DEQ seek more funding and work with the General Assembly to modify legislation that would make it easier for staff to access high-risk pre-regulatory landfill sites that are on private property. Chitlick said legislators have a strong working relationship with DEQ and have been collaborating. She is one of the primary sponsors for the Safe Parks Act, a bill that would generate funds for remediating contaminated parks in the state. Quote, "We've given DEQ more responsibility and less resources. That's just not working. We really need to equip our state government agencies with the resources that they need to be able to protect our communities." More from Durham now. Durham child care seats go empty as providers struggle to hire. A mural of cheerful flowers in the hallway leads towards classrooms filled with toys, puzzles, and cribs for nap time. Letters spelling out, "Infants are a hoot," stretch across paper branches, and owl cutouts on the wall, and new packages of diapers sit waiting to be used. But the toys remain in their bins, and the cribs sit empty at nap time. At Randy's Five Star Academy, a child care center in Durham, Director Delphia Murphy is having trouble recruiting and retaining teachers, which means the center cannot enroll up to its capacity. She is seeking an additional 6 providers in order to reopen 4 classrooms. Murphy, who is 19 teachers on staff before the pandemic and now has 7, said, "I'm used to qualified teachers that really love children. That's the only thing I know. But what I see now is that no one wants to work." Before the pandemic, nearly 80 children attended Randy's Five Star Academy, but this summer, provider shortages mean only 22 are enrolled, with another 16 having graduated from that pre-K program in May. Child care centers like Randy's received federal funding during the pandemic to pay teachers, and that money ran out in 25. Contributing to closures in Durham and across the state. As of August 10th, 135 families in Durham have been approved for subsidized child care but are waiting for a seat to open up due to a lack of providers among child care centers that accept subsidies, said Tonya Gay, who manages the subsidies at the county's Department of Social Services. At Randy's, teachers have felt the impact of turnover firsthand, filling in for classrooms where they can, and going without coverage when they're sick. Most students at the center come from low-income families and receive subsidized tuition. Teachers say the job is a hard but necessary investment in the children's future. Debbie Timmons, who teaches pre-K at Randy's, said some kids, maybe they don't get that security at home. So us teachers, we basically are maybe second parents to these children, giving them the nurture and the guidance. In Durham, parents can apply for child care subsidies through one county application, and then a group of local agencies match a child to a center. The subsidies go to a child care center to discount or eliminate the cost of attendance, depending on the program and a family's income eligibility. A combination of local, state, and federal funding supports these subsidies. Early Head Start and Head Start are federally funded programs for low-income families. They collectively serve ages 0 through 5 for free for qualifying families. Families who don't meet that income threshold for Head Start can instead qualify for the state's subsidy program, which can be used at independent child care centers that accept them. The state mandates that families receiving the subsidies pay 10% of their income to the child care provider. The NC Pre-K program is state-funded, and it serves four-year-olds at no cost to income-eligible families. Durham Pre-K is a county-funded initiative for all four-year-olds with a priority for students who are, quote, at risk, meaning they exhibit medical, financial, or academic instability. It is free, making under 450%, that can't be right, under 45% of the federal poverty level, and families making above that pay 2% of their monthly income. Each of those programs partner with child care centers to offer seats, so one pre-K class may have some seats funded by the state and others by the county, for example. Overall, there are over 2,000 families using some form of child care subsidies in Durham, according to Gay at DSS, making up about one-third of the total child care seats for this past school year. Linda Chappell, who leads efforts to improve child care equity and access in the Triangle at early years, said the funded system is blended and braided in order to create as many seats as possible. Even with this funding model, Durham's child care industry is feeling the blow from the elimination of COVID-era grants. Kate Irish, executive director at the nonprofit Durham's Partnership for Children, said the COVID-era stabilization grants helped keep child care centers afloat. As teacher shortages persist in K-12 schools across the county, independently owned child care centers find it especially difficult to keep up. Irish says if you have teacher turnover and you need to keep that classroom going, you still have to pay. You still have to make it work, so having those funds was what really enabled them to have any kind of room to breathe. Shabaka and Darlene Brannan, two partners who run Kids Corner Academy in Central Durham, used the grants to support payroll and overhead costs, receiving about $85,000 quarterly from the federal government. With the funds, they raised their teacher pay that ranged from $13 to $16 per hour before the pandemic to more than $21 per hour, gave their teachers bonuses of up to $500 per paycheck, brought families meals, and once helped a family who had become homeless live in a hotel for 2 months. But once that funding was pulled in 2025, the Brannans did not want to reduce salaries, and they were left scrambling to make up the costs. Darlene said even the light bill has gone up, the water bill, utilities, everything has just gone sky high. Everybody's being punished in a way, but we're all hurting. Kids Corner isn't the only place that struggled after grants were eliminated. North Carolina lost 367 licensed child care centers between February 2020 and December of 25, with the net loss increasing after these stabilization grants ran out. All of the seats in Kids Corner are eligible for subsidies, but for parents who can't pay 10% of their income, the Brannans front the costs, using their personal money and taking out credit to pay their staff. Durham parent Tiffany Payton received subsidies to enroll her son in Kids Corner, but she said she struggled sometimes to pay the $300 per month in fees. While her son was eligible for NC Pre-K, which is free to parents, the school day ends earlier than Payton gets off work, meaning she had to keep him in private daycare. Payton said Darlene has been accommodating during months when she's had to pay the fee late or couldn't front the money at all. It's not that I don't want to pay, I just literally don't have it. They waived the fee twice since he's been there, and I try not to do that because I already know they don't get paid enough. And then to not pay is like, okay, you're cutting in on their money even more. The county's goal is for subsidized programs for preschool to serve 75% of four-year-olds in Durham, said Chappell. But there are currently seats available for 41%. Not 75. In order to reach its goal, Durham will need to strengthen its child care workforce. Each class must follow teacher-to-student ratio requirements set by the state, and without providers, the classes cannot reach capacity. At Randy's five-star, an additional pre-K and infant class each need two providers in order to open, and an early Head Start and a Head Start class each need one more provider to fill all of the seats. Child care operators and advocates who spoke to Indy attributed the lack of providers to low salaries and limited benefits. Murphy pays her newest and least experienced provider $12 per hour, and another who has a degree and has worked in child care for more than a decade earns double that, $24. Murphy said most of her employees decline benefits because they can't afford to take a piece out of their salaries each month. But with high operational costs, it's difficult for child care centers like Murphy's to increase teacher pay. The cost of building space, equipment and supplies, food, and strict staff-to-child ratios drive up the cost of attendance, even as providers aim to keep them low for families. Murphy said about her teachers, they deserve to get more money. Providers are eligible for pay raises depending on their credentials and the program they teach. The Durham Pre-K requires every lead teacher must have or be working toward a birth through kindergarten license and get paid at the Durham Public Schools pay scale. But Chappell said the public school compensation package is still much stronger, with better benefits. Timmons says she spends about 5 hours per week outside of work preparing for class. Teachers also administer two meals and a snack each day and conduct health checks for students. She could not recall ever taking a personal day and said there are no teachers available to cover for her if she did. When Murphy interviews potential employees, she finds they can work in the restaurant industry or another hourly job where they don't have to do as much preparation or adhere to such strict standards. Murphy said it's hard to find staff who are passionate about early childhood education. This child care center has a 5-star rating from the state, which it earned for adherence to high standards of care. Murphy said if she could just hire one additional teacher as a floater, that could help with coverage if teachers had to be out. Quote, they really need mental health breaks. I know I do, and I'm the director, but they really need it, because sometimes it's rough on a person. Yannette Martinez, a teacher at Randy's, said it's stressful to frequently train new teachers and deal with the related paperwork, only for some teachers to leave after a few weeks. A study published by the National Institutes of Health in 2024 found that emotional and behavioral problems among preschool children had increased during the pandemic. Terry David, executive director at Durham Nonprofit Families and Communities Rising, said promoting wellness and increasing in-classroom support is just as important as fair pay. Quote, since COVID, I've seen more children who have challenging behaviors or children who may need additional support. So making sure there's support in the classroom for teachers, not just giving them breaks, not just wellness, but in addition to that, providing an environment where psychological safety is present. David said he's seen the child care workforce destabilize after the pandemic as federal funding for the industry has declined. Because Head Start is federally funded, increases in teacher salaries at the state level have not translated to Head Start programs. Head Start programs across the state had to pause operations during a federal government shutdown in 2025. And earlier that year, the Trump administration proposed eliminating funding for the program, prompting several state officials to write a letter to Congress opposing the cuts. The Trump administration is currently planning to strip the program of its standards of care, leaving the rulemaking up to states. David said, Head Start is federally funded and it's not a priority of the administration. Some people have left the field because they don't feel this field long term may serve their best interest. The demand for seats in infant and toddler classroom is particularly acute, said Jamiko Wells, director of programs at Durham's Partnership for Children. Those classrooms require more teachers per child, meaning the operational cost is higher and there are fewer seats available for every teacher. She said a lack of qualified staff for those classrooms leads to extensive wait lists, leading parents to get creative with child care and rely on family and neighbors. When Durham parent Shanika Paler was pregnant with her second child, she was already asking her older son's child care center for a spot in the infant class. But by the time her daughter was ready for daycare, the wait list was 8 to 12 months long. Paler relied on her family nearby and took advantage of a flexible work schedule to work from home when she needed to. Ultimately, she found a spot for her daughter at a different center, splitting up her children in order to find full coverage. Quote, when I think about even taking two kids to two separate child care centers, I'll take it. Maybe that's parental desperation. In centers that do have seats available, there are often even fewer options for families that use child care subsidies. Chappelle said many providers do not accept subsidies because the state reimbursement rate is often lower than the cost of care. According to Chappelle, the average cost of a five-star infant child care seat is $20,000 annually, which makes up nearly a quarter of the median household income in Durham. Paler said she applied for subsidies for her daughter and is waiting to hear if she will be eligible. In the meantime, she pays $1,400 per month, and she said she did, quote, a lot of work trying to find that price. To help recruit and retain teachers, Early Years offers scholarships through its TEACH program for early childhood providers to obtain degrees and certificates, and the nonprofit supplements teacher salaries through its WAGES program, which offers higher pay for increased levels of education. Murphy encourages all of her staff to seek these higher levels, and providers' education levels contribute to that center's five-star rating. Martinez, the early Head Start teacher at Randy's, received funding through TEACH to obtain a Child Development Associate Certificate and is working toward her bachelor's degree through an online program at UNC Greensboro. She said she was the second teacher to graduate from the Early Years Apprenticeship Program, and she now serves as a mentor to students. But she hears from her mentees that going through a degree program is a lot of work for a job with low pay and limited benefits. It's a lot to learn for somebody new, she said. She hopes to soon become a lead teacher in the pre-K class, which comes with a higher pay. Durham is one of few counties in the state that funds its own pre-K program, said Chappell. It launched in 2018 with a goal of providing universal child care for four-year-olds. 90 students enrolled in its inaugural year, and it has grown each year since to nearly 900 seats in DPS classrooms alone for the 25-26 school year, with additional funding supplementing seats at private centers. When Paler's son aged into pre-K, she said it was, quote, total financial relief. Her son entered publicly funded pre-K at the same time Paler's daughter began infant care. She said, we literally thanked our lucky stars that she wouldn't have to pay for child care for two kids at the same time. The county's pre-K program has demonstrated evidence of its success, with more than 9 in 10 students achieving or exceeding academic expectations. But for this upcoming school year, Durham Pre-K had to cut 34 seats due to county budget restrictions. Chappelle said there also may be cuts to pre-K seats that are partially funded from the county. It's a modest cut based on the overall number of seats in the community, but any cut is unfortunate, she said. The county also initiated a project in 2020 to try to increase seat availability for infants and toddlers, and it included plans for a child care center at the Renegade, an affordable housing complex on Main Street that opened in 25. Chappell said more than a dozen child care operators applied to operate in that space, but ultimately the top five candidates could not afford the building costs and the lease at market rate. The county is still working to find a child care operator for the space, but there are no active prospects at this time. The state budget passed in July allocated $97 million in recurring federal funding to raise subsidy rates across the state, primarily benefiting rural counties. In Durham, child care experts don't yet know exactly what that will mean for Durham's providers, said Wells at the Partnership for Children. Quote, the providers have a lot of competing costs for sure, but we're hoping that ends up meaning that programs that will be able to pay their teachers a little more to try to retain them, because it's definitely in their best interest to do that, said Wells. Still in Durham, more than half of North Carolina Central University's fundraising board has resigned. 12 of the 22 members of the foundation board of directors resigned last spring, which the university said was necessary to bring the board into compliance with its term limit rules. The university confirmed to Indy that 9 members resigned on April 17th and 2 on the 20th, and the final resignation occurred May 1st. The exit included then-President Frankie Perry, who had held the position on the board for 22 years, and Ernest Jenkins, who had been board vice president and executive director of that foundation for 14 years. The foundation itself is an independent nonprofit that fundraises for NC Central. A university spokesman said the board has had a long-standing 3-year term limit with an option for reappointment for an additional 3 years. That policy was not followed under previous board leadership, said the spokesperson, and the resignations helped the board get into compliance with its own bylaws. The spokesperson wrote in an email, this represented a necessary governance reset consistent with established membership term limits. The resigning members had served on the board for more than 100 years combined. It also represented an opportunity to move the organization toward full compliance and stronger operational alignment, unquote. Perry and Jenkins declined to comment. NC Central said Chancellor Kyrie Dixon was not available for an interview. The spring resignations also included the foundation's then-treasurer, James Williams, who the university said had served on that board for 19 years, Human Resources Chair Paula Hubbard, 12 years, Resource Committee Chair Carr Thompson, 15 years, Finance Committee Chair James Speed, 10 years, Resource Committee Member Christopher Boozer, 5 years, Audit Chair Garland Avent, 6 years, Governance Committee Chair Antoinette Burwell, 3 years, and Governance Committee Member Herbert Riviera Sanchez, 3 years. Omar Banks, who was appointed as a director on the board in 25, was also among the group that resigned. The university did not say why he left, as his 3-year term had not expired, and Banks could not be reached for comment. The university spokesman said the terms of former committee members Camaria Brown, Harry Stafford, and Charles Travis III also ended during fiscal 26. Resource committee member Calvin Crossland, who has served on the board since 23, remains in that role. The spokesperson for the university said the board's governance committee is working to appoint new members, quote, in accordance with their bylaws, and in alignment with UNC system policy, unquote. The university appreciates the steps the foundation has taken to advance compliance with UNC policies and regulations, strengthen governance, and promote alignment between the foundation and the university, said the spokesperson. The overhaul of the board came as Dixon had been trying to bolster Central's finances, and after the UNC system issued new policies for, quote, associated entities like the foundation. A December policy requires chancellors at UNC System School to appoint one-third of the voting board for such entities and mandates that they submit to the university an updated list of everyone serving on a governing board, including a list of term lengths and limits. Dixon appointed five new members to the foundation's board in January: Carla Wills, Clostrola Williams, Jeray Williams, Josh Parker, and Paul Norman. In an email to Central faculty and staff on March 20, Dixon said the university's Board of Trustees was working with the foundation and other associated entities, quote, to better understand their work and ensure alignment with institutional priorities. And he added, we are taking strong, measured steps to communicate the necessary compliance expectations and obligations that are required of our entities. On March 25th, the university announced its fundraising chief, Susan Hester, would be retiring in June. She also sat on the foundation board of the university. Hester declined the request for an interview. In an email to faculty and staff in April, Dixon announced 11 of the board members' resignations and thanked them for their service. She said the board members had, quote, chosen to step aside from their leadership roles in order to make room for new ideas, revitalized engagement, and continued stewardship of the financial contributions that the university's support generously provides. Dixon herself was hired in 24 after serving as chancellor at Elizabeth City State University, which she helped lead out of financial trouble. The year she was hired at Central, the Durham University's audit showed $45 million in financial reporting errors. In 2025, though, the audit came back clean for the first time in 3 years. But this year, Central was the only UNC system school not to meet the threshold for adequate financial health, according to a rating process done by the system. The university's chief financial officer reported to the Board of Trustees in June that Central is struggling to cover costs. The chancellor released a statement the following day in response, touting enrollment growth and financial progress. Since most of the board resigned, the chancellor's five January appointees now hold the top leadership positions. The university spokesperson said the board also appointed Jeray Williams as the foundation's interim executive director, and that Williams, quote, advised the board that an independent financial audit will be conducted to support the transition to new board leadership. The spokesperson also said the foundation is working with legal counsel to update its governing agreements and bylaws. Williams is the former chief financial officer and treasurer of Project Kitty Hawk, a program created by the state legislature for adult learners to obtain online degrees. Dixon serves on its board of directors. A million-dollar industry built around North Carolina's affordable housing tax break. Last August, Wake County Tax Administrator Marcus Kinraid was working on annual property tax bills when he noticed something strange. In just 1 year, more than $770 million worth of properties had become exempt from county taxes. In some cases, tax bills had dropped from hundreds of thousands of dollars to zero. At first, Kinraid thought it was a mistake. He told the Indy, I began digging through our database and applications to make sure we didn't make some sort of significant error. But it quickly became apparent that a tax break historically used by nonprofit developers to build affordable housing was now being used by dozens of private developers across Wake County to reduce their tax bills. A legal loophole established in 2013 by the NC Court of Appeals, Blue Ridge Housing of Bakersville, opened the door for developers to take advantage of the tax break and a small industry of nonprofits, lawyers, and real estate brokers has formed to walk them through it. Under the current law, nearly all, up to 94% of Wake County's apartments, duplexes, condos, and other multifamily units could potentially qualify for this tax break as affordable housing. Nonprofit Self-Help Credit Union told North Carolina legislators in January, depending on the rents charged, property owners could use the tax break to significantly boost their profits. Kinraid said, referring to the self-help presentation, "I can only describe that as a lightning bolt moment. My jaw dropped. I realized the Blue Ridge case was now a full-blown loophole that was being completely exploited." A bill filed earlier this year in the House of North Carolina government would close that loophole by limiting eligibility to property that is either 100% owned and operated by an affordable housing nonprofit or supported with government funding like low-income housing tax credits. But it hasn't advanced in more than 2 months. Some private developers argue that with the financial stresses facing them right now, like insurance rate hikes, rising interest, increased operating costs, the Blue Ridge tax break is an invaluable tool for preserving affordable workforce housing. Graham Whitaker, Government Affairs Director for the Triangle Apartment Association, wrote in a statement to Indy, "By reducing operating costs, the exemption enables property owners to keep rents affordable while continuing to reinvest in their communities. Our goal is to strike the right balance by closing the loophole for bad actors while preserving the incentive for responsible providers who deliver long-term affordability." But in the meantime, local governments across the state like Wake County scrambled to adjust their budget this year as they faced millions in lost property tax revenue, and they may face an even worse deficit next year. The General Assembly created that tax break in 1975 to give financial leniency to property, quote, "used for charitable purposes." That includes, reads the statute, "nonprofit organizations providing housing for individuals or families with low or moderate incomes." For years, the county used it to support affordable housing built by long-time nonprofit developers, projects that were typically 100% owned by nonprofits, and used these credits, making them subject to strict requirements on rent prices. A loophole was created when the Court of Appeals ruled properties don't have to be wholly owned as by a nonprofit to qualify. The property that was the subject of the case, an apartment complex in Mitchell County, was 99.9% owned by a for-profit partnership. Since then, private developers have been able to get that tax break by meeting a few simple conditions outlined in the Blue Ridge case, including handing over at least 0.1% of their company to a registered nonprofit. The size of the tax breaks that properties receive depends on how much affordable housing they offer. An apartment complex in Northwest Raleigh, for example, Conclave Glenwood, only qualified for 53% exemption. That's presumably because only about half the apartments there are considered affordable, while the rest are market rate. Before 2023, Kinraid saw only 2 or 3 applications per year for that tax break in Wake County, but in 2024, that number shot up to more than 20 and has continued to rise. This year, the county received 170 applications. That's about a 500% increase in just 2 years. As long as properties meet all the criteria, North Carolina counties have no choice but to grant them a tax exemption. since 24th. Wake County has denied only two applications out of hundreds, said Kindred. The denials stem from applications dealing with the vacant land allegedly for future affordable housing development, although the developers had no history of building affordable housing. The massive spike in property tax exemption have left the county in an increasingly difficult financial position. Earlier this year, officials contended with the loss of millions in revenue and struggled to find essential services like education and public safety. Kinraid said, "It's fairly egregious from my perspective. It's just not right." He added, "The loss of revenue increases the tax burden on Raleigh homeowners. The people who live here and own residential property, they're having to subsidize these for-profit investors who are taking advantage of this loophole. To receive a tax exemption, property owners must offer rents that are affordable for people making at or below 80% of the area median income, AMI. But because Wake County is home to some of the highest earners in the state, property owners can charge rents that are out of reach for many residents and still qualify. According to numbers from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, a one-bedroom apartment in Raleigh could cost up to $1,900 per month, including rent and utilities, and still qualify for the tax break. For a two-bedroom, the cost could climb to $2,300 per month and still be considered affordable. Depending on where an apartment complex is located, those limits can fall hundreds of dollars above the average market rate and cost of an apartment in Raleigh. Many of the one-bedrooms that received that tax break this year offer rents starting around $1,000 per month, but those numbers don't take into account the cost of utilities or mandatory fees, which can push apartments into the realm of unaffordability for some residents. People making less than $50,000 a year face the biggest affordable housing shortage by far, according to county data. In contrast, Wake County has a slight surplus of rental housing affordable for people making more than 80% of AMI. That's about $74,000 per year for a single person. Morgan Mansa, director of Wake County Housing Affordability and Community Revitalization, told Indy, "If you're earning $75,000, $150,000, it's scarce, but there are some units available within our community. It doesn't mean we stop building for those price points because more than 60 people are moving to our community every day. But in full transparency, the saturation of need is on the lower end of the income band." Several of the nonprofits that benefit from the tax break state online, they're helping preserve a valuable workforce housing, meaning those who earn more than 60% AMI, that's an income band, the nonprofits argue, that is less supported by government programs while also being priced out of the market. But unlike past projects supported by the tax break, there's no requirement these properties remain affordable long-term. Rent price restrictions can be changed at any time, and apartments can return to market rate, but would no longer receive the tax break. LIHTC projects like Milner Commons, on the other hand, are subject to complex federal requirements that ensure the housing built will be affordable for years to come. Milner Commons, that's an apartment complex for low-income seniors, was built in 24 by DHIC, formerly the Downtown Housing Improvement Corporation, a longtime affordable nonprofit. Milner Commons was also eligible for Wake County's property tax exemption, which, quote, really makes the projects we're developing financially feasible, said Yolanda Winstead, president and CEO of DHIC. With the help of tax breaks, Milner Commons apartment rents are as low as $500 per month to low-income seniors. The homes are guaranteed to be affordable to people making 30 to 60% of AMI, with rents dependent on income. Unlike Milner Commons, many of the properties that have received the tax break in the last 2 years are not touting affordability in their advertising. Words like premier and boutique pop up on many websites. Village at Broadstone Station, an apartment complex in Apex, advertises luxury living, complete with a saltwater pool and cabanas, fully equipped fitness center, and expansive dog park. The entire property was exempt from county taxes starting in 2025 after it was sold in 24 to a real estate investment group based in California. The owners avoided paying more than $300,000 in property taxes by keeping rents affordable to people making 80% AMI. As of July, available one-bedrooms started at around $1,300 per month, according to the website. Winstead is alarmed by the trend, she said, since private developers could pass those property tax savings along to investors rather than using the money to cover operational costs and keep rents low. While dozens of Wake County properties have received tax breaks in the last 2 years, a handful of law firms and nonprofits were involved in securing them, an Indy investigation found. Kinraid said, there is a whole niche industry that's been carved out relative to this tax break in the last 3 years. We saw these out-of-state nonprofits and a few local law firms really increasing their efforts to make this part of their business models. They started actively advertising their services and promoting this. Often, developers or their nonprofit partners will hire lawyers to help them restructure the businesses and ensure the application's approval. In some cases, nonprofits spent tens of thousands of dollars on legal services, helping property owners secure the Blue Ridge tax break, according to IRS filings. In 2024, for example, the nonprofit Southeast Affordable Housing Administration, SAHA, paid $115,000 to Anthony Thompson for, quote, legal counsel, from the IRS records. He is a former Nelson Mullins lawyer, a firm involved in many tax break applications, and is the current SAHA general counsel. He didn't respond to requests for an interview, but did share a written statement with the Indy, quote, SAHA exists to protect affordability for the families already living in North Carolina's older, naturally occurring affordable housing. The apartments that were never part of a federal program and can quietly lose that affordability one unit at a time. The property tax exemption is the tool that makes that affordability possible. IRS records show SAHA, founded in 2021, earned around $2 million in 2024 from its work partnering with properties to, quote, implement tax abatements across both North and South Carolina. The organization spent about $400,000 of tax money on tenant rent relief, including services for tenants like case management and a credit building program, as well as community activities like back-to-school drives. In the same year, SAHA spent more than double that, around $900,000, on, quote, consulting, legal, and organizational and marketing support services from Affordable Upstate, a multifamily real estate investment firm based in South Carolina. The firm is helmed by Mario Brown, son of SAHA's executive director, Dolores Brown. Affordable Upstate owns and manages many of the properties that SAHA has helped qualify for this tax break, said Mario Brown in a phone interview. The company works with SAHA to support tenants and provide rent payment programs and security deposit alternatives. Much of that work is enabled by the tax break, according to Thompson. SAHA also pays the firm, quote, to go out and originate partnerships with other property owners, said Brown. In other words, to find property owners interested in partnering with SAHA to qualify for the tax break. Affordable Upstate educates property owners interested in affordable housing on how the incentive works and assists with compliance, according to Brown. Quote, the nonprofit itself doesn't have the ability to go out and canvass the market. Several of the nonprofits helping properties qualify for tax breaks experience direct benefits of their own. The Foundation for Affordable Housing, FFAH, a registered nonprofit based in Oregon and incorporated in California, helped clients with property in Wake County qualify for $3 million in tax breaks this year. According to the Indies analysis, half the property tax revenue Kinraid expects Wake County to lose in 2026. FFAH operated through one of its many subsidiaries, the Foundation for Affordable Housing, V. It partnered with properties across North Carolina, including Village at Broadstone Station. While the majority of FFAH V revenue went back into the operation and maintenance of its properties, company officials also made a significant amount of money. In 24, President and CEO Darren Willard took home around $850,000 in compensation from, quote, related to organizations, according to IRS filings. And in 2022, FFAH co-founder and former FFAH 5, President Deborah Willard received a $2.5 million bonus on top of her $500,000 salary. Neither Darren Willard nor Deborah Willard could be reached for comment, despite multiple attempts by Indy across several weeks. All right, John Fetterson will leave this article because he has to, and it is intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, as you know, I hope, and we will be back next week with the Independent from the North Carolina Reading Service.